time for a dispatch on the mixed-up lives of vampires. They're best known for sucking their victims' blood, but somehow vampires manage to be eerily attractive, at least in pop culture. Two series are dominating bestseller lists, the Twilight books and the Southern Vampire books, which are the basis of HBO's latest hit, True Blood. Both have vampire heroes who practice remarkable restraint, as NPR's Lynn Neary reports.
I am Dracula. I bid you welcome.
You don't see much blood, or fangs for that matter, in the 1931 film Dracula, but when Bela Lugosi leans over his victims, he is one creepy guy. And when this vampire wants a pretty woman, he takes her with no remorse. Vampires, or something like them, have been part of culture since ancient times, says my colleague Eric Newsom, who has written about the creatures in his book, The Dead Travel Fast. And while vampires cannot see their own reflection in the mirror, Newsom says they are a perfect reflection of the culture which creates them.
You look at vampires from any given era and you see what they thought was frightening. You see what they thought was sexy and what they thought was forbidden.
The latest craze, Newsom says, is the romantic, even chivalrous vampire. Take True Blood, for example. The HBO series is set in a time when vampires prowl openly through small-town America and even campaign for their civil rights. Suki Stackhouse, a young, pretty waitress, falls for a vampire named Bill. And like any young woman, her interest only intensifies when others object to her new crush.
He's not like that?
Okay, you spoke to him for like a minute. You don't know how many people he's sucked the blood out of over the last however many centuries he's been alive.
But he's so not scary.
Sweet Jesus in heaven, Suki, he is a vampire.
True Blood is based on the Southern Vampires book series written by Charlaine Harris. She inhabits her fictional world with both good and bad vampires. But in Bill, she creates a genteel vampire who protects Suki from the worst of his kind, even as he tries to rein in his own baser instincts. And of course, says Harris, his restraint makes him all the more alluring.
Yes, definitely. Gosh. I could rip you limb from limb, but because I think you're so great, I'm going to be very, very careful. That's got to be kind of intoxicating.
But the gentleman vampire who has stolen the heart of teenage girls everywhere is Edward, the hero of Stephanie Meyer's Twilight series, soon to be released as a movie. Edward's fans live vicariously through his romance with high school sweetheart Bella.
You know what you are? Your skin is pale white and ice cold. Don't go out into the sunlight.
Say it out loud. Say it.
Vampire.
Are you afraid?
No.
Edward and his clan refuse to feed off humans, and it is that choice, says Meyer, that makes him so popular.
These are vampires who should be these creatures who exist to hunt humans. I mean, they're evil, and they choose something different. They find another way. And I think that kids respond to the idea that it doesn't matter where I am in life, I always have a choice.
Vampires aren't supposed to be restrained. They're all our hungers. That's why they're vampires.
Nina Auerbach, author of Our Vampires Ourselves, believes every age gets the vampire it wants. In the 1960s and 70s, she says, vampires took young women away from their narrow lives and transformed them. It's understandable, she says, that with the advent of AIDS, uninhibited blood sucking may have lost some of its appeal. Still, she finds this latest crop of vampires kind of boring.
And these are very abstinent vampires. The implication being, if he truly loves you, he will not do it to you. And I'm old, and I thought if he truly loves you, you would have a wonderful time together.
Whether they terrify, entrance, or court their victims, vampires are always on the prowl, waiting for that moment when the moon comes out and the cultural spotlight shines on them again. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
Studs Terkel died yesterday in his beloved Chicago at the age of 96. For decades and decades, the Pulitzer Prize-winning oral historian traveled the country interviewing ordinary people, allowing them to tell their stories to a larger world. Back in 1995, he shared one of his interviewing techniques with his friend, Scott Simon, forgetting to hit the record button on the tape machine.
These are the not celebrated people, not authors or musicians. This is, say, someone in a housing project, and I forgot to press the button. Jeez, you didn't press that. And I said, oh, thank you. At that moment, she feels not only my equal, my superior. See, at that moment, I'm not this guy with a mic from Mount Olympus coming down to Earth to do it, but this goofball with this machine. And she helps me. Some people accuse me of deliberately goofing it up so I can make that other person feel better. That's not so. I'm just inept. It's simple as that.
Weekend Edition Scott Simon joins us now from member station KUT in Austin, Texas. And Scott, I'm sorry for the loss of your good friend. He was a true original. Can you tell us what made Studs unique?
Well, as you suggested, he perfected, if not outright invented, oral history as a form, beginning with his book Division Street America in the mid-60s, which I read as a kid. I guess The Good War, which won the Pulitzer in 1985, is still the best known. And, he used the technique in Division Street that just sounds so deceptively simple to tell the life stories of people who lived along a single street that ran the breadth of Chicago from east to west. If I might speak as a Chicagoan, he made our city sing. He took the stories of the men and women who ride the red line from north to south and work the overnight shift, and he really turned them into the music of living. And though Chicago was obviously his base, he used the city just as much as Algren or James T. Farrell or Richard Wright or Saul Bellow to show places all over the world that there were stories hidden in the lives of people there that were treasures to be excavated, and they glittered as literature.
Why do you believe he was good at what he did?
I was laughing so much at that clip that you played because it absolutely genuine. It's not as if Studs was some great technological wizard who had to feign ineptitude. He didn't have a driver's license, as I don't, and I'm prepared to say that the world has been a safer place because neither of us had a driver's license. But he put himself in a position where, because people had to help him out, it changed the whole identity of the interview. Suddenly he had to call on their better nature. And it made them more confident in an interview. Rather than be deferential or defensive, he was someone that they were trying to help out. And you can hear that confidence in the interviews he did because people are expressing themselves from a position of confidence. And it's what made a lot of his interviews not just different but extraordinary.
Scott, are there any special stud stories you can share with us?
Yeah, there are about 100 I can't. I'm here at the Texas Book Festival, and people have been asking me stud stories, and they all have punchlines I can't repeat. I just can't repeat. He was famously and creatively profane. But I do recall a number of years ago, we were in a hotel bar. He was having his scotch, and there were a couple of people who came over to him. He was very identifiable, and they essentially wanted to tell him his life story. He was the repository of life stories of the last resort. And there was a woman, she seemed to have some problem. I forget what it was, but let's just say that she thought that she'd had sex with space aliens. And I said to him something like, well, you could never interview her. And he said, well, that's not true, because in another dimension of her life, there might be a very compelling story going on. In fact, I'd be interested what was going on in her life that makes her think that she's had sex with space aliens. And he said, Pally, lots of people say you must have to go through like hundreds, hundreds of interviews to get the two or three that work. And he said, no, you don't. You can make almost anyone work as an interview. It works. You just have to talk to them enough. You just have to give them the chance. Everybody's got their story. Just let them sing, Pally. Let them sing.
That's good for all of us to remember, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Scott Simon, thanks for checking in. And again, we're sorry for your loss.
Thank you, Allison.
We're going to go out now with Studs Terkel reading the Carl Sandburg poem, Chicago.
Chicago. Hog butcher for the world, tool maker, stacker of wheat, player with railroads and the nation's freight handler, stormy, husky, brawling, city of the big shoulders. They tell me you are wicked, and I believe them. For I've seen your painted women under the gas lamps luring the farm boys. And they tell me you are crooked, and I answer, yes, it's true. I've seen the gunman kill and go free and kill again. And they tell me you are brutal. My reply is, on the faces of women and children, I have seen the marks of wanton hunger. And having answered so, I turn once more to those who sneer at this, my city, and I give them back the sneer and say to them, come and show me another city with lifted head, singing, so proud to be alive and coarse and strong and cunning, flinging magnetic curses amid the toil of piling job on job. Here is a tall, bold slugger set vivid against the little soft cities. Fierce as a dog with tongue lapping for action, cunning as a savage pitted against the wilderness, bareheaded, shoveling, wrecking, planning, building, breaking, rebuilding. Under the smoke, dust all over his mouth, laughing with white teeth. Under the terrible burden of destiny, laughing as a young man laughs, laughing even as an ignorant fighter laughs who has never lost a battle. Bragging and laughing that under his wrist is the pulse, and under his ribs the heart of the people. Laughing. Laughing the stormy, husky, brawling laughter of youth, half naked, sweating, proud to be hog butcher, tool maker, stacker of wheat, player with railroads, and freight handler to the nation.
Studs Terkel reading Carl Sandburg's Chicago. Mr. Terkel died yesterday in Chicago. He was 96.
Think of some of the photographs that we all know instantly. A World War II sailor grabs a nurse and plants a kiss on her in the middle of Times Square. Can't you just see that image? Here's another one. A beaming Harry S. Truman holds a newspaper up in the air. The headline, Dewey defeats Truman. You had that one before I finished the sentence. America got its first look at those photos in the pages of Life magazine. Well, last year, Life, it died. But Life Books is taking over where the magazine left off. A new compilation of Life's most indelible images is out. It's called Life, the Classic Collection. Bobby Baker Burrows is the director of photography for Life Books, and she joins me from NPR's New York studios. Hello.
Good afternoon.
This is just an amazing array of photographs in this book. We have a slideshow of them on our website, npr.org. People can follow along there. The one I want to start with is on page 100. Let's turn to that. It was taken from the point of view of a puppet show looking at the kids watching the puppet show.
St. George and the Dragon.
And the faces of these children express the whole range of human emotion, it feels like. You've got wonder and amazement and joy and even a little fear all at once. It's just this living, vibrant photograph.
Yes, and this was what was so special about our photographers. Eisy shot this, Alfred Eisenstadt, in 1963. It's in Paris, in the Tuileries Park. He was actually shooting the puppet show. And like a lot of the great photographers, he would wonder, what angle don't I have? What should I shoot that no one else is shooting? And anticipation. He always said anticipation was so important. So he anticipated that these children would react like that at the end of the show.
You could almost look at this picture forever, just find new emotions in it. It's almost, you know, an analog for the entire book itself, because across all of the photos in this book, you see such a range of emotions. Page 26. There is a fabulous portrait of Salvador Dali.
Yeah.
I don't even know how you do this picture.
What?
As my producer said, this is Photoshopped, but of course it's not.
No, it's not.
It's Dali standing by his easel, and there is water shooting out of one side of the picture and falling under the ground, and three black cats being thrown across this picture. It's just unbelievable. It's just so surreal.
Well, Salvador Dali was just so eccentric himself, and Philippe Halsman was known for his, you may have heard of the jump book. He got all these famous people to jump for him, including the Duke and Duchess of Windsor. And through that technique, everybody let their hair down. So he took it to another extreme with this photograph.
It's just
fantastically difficult to figure out.
It took them 6 hours, and I think they threw everything 28 times. And everybody, at the end of this photo session, everybody was completely collapsed. The only live thing that was still jumping were the cats. They were just all set to go again.
That's great. Let's go on to two radically different views of the Kennedys. Starting with this picture, it's a Hank Walker shot. He was the photographer of Jack and Bobby Kennedy talking in a hotel room, sitting across from one another. And it's backlit so that you just see the silhouettes of these two men, but you can tell so easily who they are.
It's a very intimate moment between Jack and Bobby on the campaign trail. It was in the Los Angeles Hotel in 1960. And I believe they were discussing Lyndon Johnson being on the ticket. And that was not sitting well with Bobby. And, you know, the interesting thing is photographers, this is the trust that our subjects had. Our photographers were allowed in when sometimes the most personal conversations were taking place, knowing full well that this would remain private.
This next photograph gives me chills. It's on the next page. It's the moment after Bobby Kennedy has been shot and is lying on the...
It's in the kitchen at the Los Angeles Hotel.
And there's a busboy crouched by Bobby Kennedy's head. And the busboy is, you know, Bobby Kennedy's
sort of... Juan Romero is his name.
Bobby Kennedy's face is half lit, and the busboy looks up at the camera in this just in the moment that he realizes, you know, the world has ended.
Yes. There was a moment there where everything was clear around him, and Bill Eppridge, who shot this picture, being very sensitive and knowing that this is his friend. Not just somebody who's running for president. This was his friend lying on the floor. In 1 second, Bill had to make that decision. He was there to document it. There were other people there that could try to save him. And the crowd parted. He shot two frames. One was a little blurred. In this one, the busboy just looked at him. He saw that stare, snapped the picture, and it all closed in again.
Bobby Baker Burroughs, after looking at all these beautiful, awe-inspiring photos, it's kind of a shame that Life magazine doesn't exist anymore to document our culture.
It really is, and I'm forever hopeful. You know, I'm a Pollyanna. I think Life, why do we have that name? Life, you can't kill it. It'll come out again. Well, we're starting a website, which will, you know, that'll be interesting and fun. And, who knows? There may be a place for it again sometime, somewhere. And I'm always forever hopeful. I say never, never say it's gone for good.
Bobby Baker Burroughs is the director of photography for Life Books. The new compilation of photographs is called Life, the Classic Collection. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Check out that slideshow at our website with Bobby Baker Burroughs talking about a few of the classic images from the book. It's at npr.org.
Just as a blockbuster thriller movie leads to a sequel, more blood, more suspense, more chainsaws, a series of scary kids' books has created a market for more. The series was called Goosebumps, and it was wildly popular in the 1990s. It sold more than 300 million copies worldwide. Now, R.L. Stine and his publisher hope the fan base will buy into his new Goosebumps series called Horrorland. NPR's Lynn Neary reports on a drive to recapture a fan base that is still loyal and still large.
Anyone who might think that Goosebumps is a thing of the past would have been disabused of that notion at this year's National Book Festival here in Washington, D.C. Book lovers lined up all along the National Mall, waiting to get autographs from their favorite authors. But late arrivals for the R.L. Stine line were out of luck.
R.L. Stine, keep going.
You are kidding.
The end of that fourth line is the end of R.L. Stine.
The line stretched halfway across the National Mall till it reached the sidewalk and then began twisting around like a snake. Anyone standing at the end had little chance of meeting the creator of Goosebumps. For those at the front of the line, the wait was worth it.
Have 142 of your books.
No, you do not. You
I'm a big fan of yours.
You come here. You're kidding me.
There were little kids, big kids, moms and dads, even a scattering of 20-somethings nostalgic for the books of their childhood. And all of them had a favorite scary story. Here's a sampling from Jacob Mayer, Roland Cooney, Marianne Warwick, and Juliana Eaton.
Well, especially the Monster Blood 4.
Why is that?
Because in Monster Blood 4, or unlike the other Monster Bloods, they're blue creatures, and if they drink water, they duplicate.
My favorite's the Living Dummy one, Living Dummy. Dummies look scary to begin with, and then he had it start walking, talking, and trying to hurt people, and that really made me, like look over my shoulder.
I had nightmares with the Haunted Teddy Bear book.
Oh, you did? Why?
Because I have lots of stuffed animals, so I was afraid one of them would come alive and eat me.
Oh, really? Did you have to put your teddy bears away for a little while?
Or? No.
Just one.
Oh, yeah. Just one. Because it looked like it had hawk eyes.
One of the biggest ones for me was the blob that ate everyone. And this was just, this wasn't like as scary as some of his other ones. The ending was actually really comical. You read it and you just like started cracking up because it was like, oh my gosh, he's crazy.
Stein may not be crazy, but he is funny. He began his career as a humorist known as Jovial Bob Stein, and he still sees a close connection between humor and horror. Ask him about everyone's favorite scary holiday, Halloween, and he tells this story about the time his parents went to buy him a costume for trick-or-treating.
I really wanted to be something scary. I wanted to be a mummy, or I wanted to be a ghost or a vampire. And they came home from the store, and I opened the box, and it was a duck costume with a fuzzy yellow tail. I actually used the duck costume in one of my Halloween Goosebumps books called The Haunted Mask. So I did make use of it later.
Were you able to scare anyone with that duck costume?
No.
Stein's writing process is a little different from most authors. He says he begins with the title and figures out the rest from there.
Let's say I have an idea for a story, and if I can't think of a good title for it, I just throw away the idea.
Really? You just get rid of the idea?
You never know. When you get good titles, too. I was walking the dog in the park, and this title popped in my head, Say Cheese and Die. Where did that come from? It just, there it was. It was a title. It had to be something about an evil camera, right?
It is Stein's genius for combining humor and horror that is the key to his appeal to kids, says children's book expert Anita Silvey. Because kids love to be scared, but not too scared.
If you can laugh about being a little bit scared, then it doesn't make it so bad when you find yourself that you are scared. So these books allow them to kind of laugh at the fear, to walk through the fear, and if it gets too much, to put it down and go get a peanut butter sandwich and be perfectly okay.
When the Goosebump books were in their heyday, some adults disapproved. They thought they were too scary or complained the books were formulaic and not well written. Here and there, a school or a library tried to ban Goosebumps. Some adults just didn't like the books, says Sylvie.
They were really very afraid of what effect they might have on children. And the only effect that truly they seem to have had is that they got them reading and they kept them reading and they got them excited about reading. And that is a great skill of an author, to be able to get children to finish one of your books and then want to pick up another. I mean, that is really what every author wants.
Stein takes great pride in his reputation for getting kids excited about reading. He says he's constantly meeting parents who are grateful to him for getting their kids interested in books.
Parents come up now and say, my kid never read a book in his life, and last night I caught him reading with a flashlight under the blankets at 2 a.m. So I'm very proud of that.
Stein thinks kids are reading more than ever now, and his publisher, Scholastic, certainly hopes he's right. Scholastic also published the Harry Potter series, and with no new Potter book in sight, revenues are down sharply and the company's cutting back. Scholastic is hoping the magic will strike again with Stein's new Goosebumps Horrorland series. As for Stein, he's just happy to be doing what he loves and what his fans want.
What am I going to be remembered for? It's going to be Goosebumps. So it's very exciting for me to be back doing it. And as far as I know, we're doing very well. Somehow the Goosebumps audience never really went away. It was a craze for a while. It was an enormous worldwide craze. And that can never last. But the books have sold all this time, even when there were no new ones coming out, which I'm just very lucky.
As for the kids who are reading his books, Stein says despite all the emphasis on technology, he doesn't think they've changed much. They still like a good scare, and they still like to laugh. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
You can read text or listen to an audio excerpt of R.L. Stein's Revenge of the Graveyard Dummy on our website, npr.org.
For more about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.